Let me just quickly lead in very shortly here. This is a tape-recorded oral history interview with Dr. Edward Bowles. We're at his home in Wesley Hills, Massachusetts. Interviewer is Martin Collins speaking and Michael Dennis. The date is July 15, 1987. This is tape one, side one. Dr. Bowles, we'd like to start this interview with a brief sketch of your family background, when you were born, where you were born, who your parents were, what they did, and let's start with that.
I was born in December, on December 9, 1897. So I'm coasting my way to 90 this month, this year. My father was a horseback country doctor. My father was a horseback country doctor, starting his practice out there in the Ozark foothills, 1886. He was a graduate in law at Washington University. I'd have to look at a diploma. I think it was around 76 or somewhere in there. He began to practice law, and as I understand it from his own lips, it was distasteful to him to, let me say, defend criminals. A bit of emotion, I grant. So he gave up the law and went to study medicine. He took a certain amount of work in one of the medical schools in St. Louis. He then went to the Kentucky School of Medicine, which in those days was, I believe, one of the relatively top institutions. And he obtained a degree in medicine from the Kentucky School of Medicine. And in those days, if you apprenticed yourself to a surgeon, you got a kind of a rump degree in surgery. In other words, typically the apprentice method. His diploma was kind of hand-hewn by the surgeon. But in those days, as I understand it, that was a custom. In other words, you got that special degree through apprenticing yourself to a forefront individual in the field. Now, as I read what material I've been able to put my hands on, at the end of his medical training, he had looked around some of the small towns in Missouri with the idea of finding a place to practice. His parents were slaveholders in Missouri. As you probably know, Missouri was a divided state in the field of slavery, split. They had two or more, not estates, but I can't remember the term, on the river outside of St. Louis, the Gasconade River. So he was brought up with a background of slavery. My mother's father had become a prominent corporation lawyer in St. Louis. I understand she belonged to the Methodist Episcopalian religion. As an aside, I was the youngest of five, and I never remember any discussion between them, slavery versus freedom of the black. And in the language of that period, my father was raised on the back of a, as they would call, a nigger mammy. It's always astounded me that, although I was the youngest of five, this, as I recall it, my childhood was never an issue as to a matter of slavery. Nor was there ever any question with respect to religion. I know later in life that I grew up, I was old enough for my father to talk with me about such matters. It was his policy, if you can call it that, that we should be able to seek our own religion. We never had any compulsion one way or the other. By way of background of my father, in this Missouri town of Westphalia, where we were all raised, it was an all-Catholic community. We were the only Protestants. All five of us, that is, the children, went to the convent. All our grammar school education up through the eighth grade was in St. Joseph's School in Westphalia. We each and every one of us took all the instruction that was given preparatory to taking First Communion. In those days out there, there was a First and Second Communion, which when I mention it nowadays to Catholics, they sometimes raise their eyebrows because it isn't staple in the discussions. But I did listen to the instructions of the priest. There was never any distinction between me as an individual and the rest of the children. We played together. It was never an issue. I credit my father in part because he was emphatic in our never questioning of the belief of the people. His relationship to the church, the convent, as I look back on it, was a beautiful one. And so I became a kind of a rump authority on the Catholic Church. because later, when I came to Tech, I had the advantage of the library at Boston College through MIT, and when some puzzling question came up out there, I'd get a note from some of the people in my hometown asking questions. I could look up the history of the settlement of the town. And what this did for me, of course, was to not simply give me tolerance, but in my later examination of the whole matter, I had some understanding of the formalities of the Catholic religion. I won't go into that, but in later life, members of the family performed experiments on me. There seems to be an inherent desire to convert people one way or another. But we went through that experience at Westphalia, summarizing my father's position. He became a legend among these farmers. It was an agricultural community, almost solely. And with my own emotions as a son, and from actual experience, when he came into a home when a person was ill, a lot of them got well, just the confidence that here he was taking care of them. And I saw the practice of medicine, something entirely different from what one sees when he becomes a grown-up. They had great affection for my father. I won't get into that, but when I go back even today to see the second generation or maybe further along the line, I can go into any home and not only am I welcome, but we can have wonderful discussions on the community problems. The town has a magnificent population. What is it, Janet? 250, 75?
85.
Janet's been out there. But on the matter of my own life, I was the youngest of five. Above me were three sisters. Then the fifth was my brother. The oldest. And in what I would call my growing up period, I had the advantage that in my association with my brother, who was roughly about 10 years older, without looking up precise dates, he was born, I believe I can say, with a bent toward those things that are mechanical. Ultimately, he was a graduate of Missouri University, electrical engineering. And not only was his education a natural result of the way people are born with certain indigenous instincts, but he could grasp readily any technical innovations that came through association with others. I didn't see this directly because I was too young. But as often happens in the country, an itinerant soul came through the town and in a sense, passed on a lot of things like how to solder and how to cut muriatic acid with zinc to make a flux. He taught my brother how to make an acetylene generator. Now that sounds remote today. But my brother was ingenious at things of that sort. So I like to believe that that was an influence on me when I came along, because a lot of this equipment was around, and that was the atmosphere I had from association with my brother. When it came to the first gasoline engine that came into the neighborhood, but my brother, they called on to show him how to start it. It was a mystery. Now that's not a reflection on the people, but it was new. And somehow they depended on him as if he was a wunderkind. The town, that I'm including in that town, the farmers in the surrounding areas. It had been carefully organized by the Jesuits. I don't recall the precise date, but it goes back to about 1930. And for me, as a child, that was quite a while ago. There was a blacksmith shop, which later was to be part of my education. I put that at the lead because, it being a farming community, there had to be repair work on plows and the harvesting machines, hay mowers, and above all, shoeing of horses. There was a cabinet maker. There were country stores, two, and then ultimately three, even in that little town. A saddlery, obviously an intimate part of life on a horse. And the plowing and so on. There was a country hotel. Associated with the hotel was a bar. There was a tailor. So one might say, in essence, the town, excepting for having to import certain things and very few things, it was self-sustaining. There was a wagon maker, I forgot to mention that, who went as far as to make farm wagons, do all the painting, and turn out a wagon that was, in my young mind, beautiful. But in that climate, one couldn't help but learn by association or by absorption or any other natural process. And as a youngster, somehow all these activities excited me, and I learned a bit about wax forging, of that sort of forging at least. I wasn't yet a politician, but I look back and think of which was available that it excited a young one. Of course, this presupposes that you're disposed to accept that background. I got to know the cabinet maker exceedingly well and got to helping him do his job. Later, I made a big lot of furniture because I enjoyed, when I went to St. Louis to high school, because I found myself in an environment of tools, that is, facilities that I'd never dreamed could exist. So there were natural impulses to push me along. I can't claim any credit. It was the surroundings. Now, within that milieu, or whatever one would like to term it, there was an old professional trapper. I used to kind of wish I could have his hide because he was so hairy. I thought if one skinned him, it would be useful. But I had at every hand a natural impulse to learn, and it wasn't by pedagogical means. It was simply that you were in that environment. So I hunted, fished, and trapped. In the trapping, and I have to say I was a youngster, and hard as it may seem to take, it is where I like to believe skill counted. And so it did try one's imagination. In simple words, I spent a lot of time trailing the lower animal. And therefore, it was kind of natural, if I may inject it, I kept trailing later the human animal with as much vigor and as much satisfaction. But that experience, again, even though I was dealing with what people like to call the lower animals, it gave one a feeling for animal life with which you're surrounded. And it ultimately, I think, helped me in later life with the human animal. It's much more complicated. Now, in the trapping, this man I talked about, who was a hairy soul, he regarded me as a nuisance when he saw me wandering around in the woods because I was invading his, or violating his prerogatives and sense of possession. So he never talked to me. And one winter, I captured or caught and skinned 3 mink. And in those days, the mink were the animals that gave you the most money per skin. St. Louis was a great fur center, raw hides. And so that brought me in touch with the business of skinning the animal, then at the end of the season, sending the skins to, I believe it was Funston Brothers in St. Louis, the middle of the country, fur trading area. Catching 3 minks that winter, it turned out that the old trapper failed to catch any. And what that did for me, this is all looking back and trying to fill in the spaces. That man was willing to meet me out in the woods and talk with me. And it was natural for him to begin to pry around a little bit and try to find out how it was that I caught 3 mink that winter and he caught none in the same trapping area. And as I translated, that made me a member of his fraternity. And we got along beautifully after that and exchanged views. This is an aside, but we'll have to use a little shellac in places. We were up out in the woods one day exchanging views on how to do this, that, and the other. A snake happened to invade our area. While he was talking to me about trap lines and various animals, possums and raccoons and what have you, he reached in his pocket and got out his knife, put his foot on the snake behind its head, and he reached down and cut the head off. Casually, without even stopping the conversation. And of course, that amused me, I suppose. Put the knife back in his pocket. And as we went on to talk, he pulled out a great big plug of tobacco. Took a big chew. But first he had to pull out his knife, open it up, and cut off the slice of tobacco. Didn't bother him in the least. But this was all of the ritual. And I've remembered that. But I remember particularly that this may be a member of his fraternity. A very little thing in one sense, a very big thing in another. Now, naturally, my father, being a doctor, I picked up casual information. My father was very careful to educate me without it sounding like an education, by explaining the various drugs and the specifics in medicine, and there were very few specifics in those early days. But I remember when, I believe it was, Barbara. What is it used on the eyes to desensitize the membrane?
What did you say? What did they use?
Not codeine, but...
Atropine?
No, you're on the way, but...
You mean when you were in for your surgery?
No, I was talking about my father.
Oh, I don't know.
And when it was discovered that there was a medication that you could put a drop, where you could put a drop in the eye and it would desensitize the surface.
I thought you said it was codeine.
Was it?
I thought you said that, yeah.
I'll accept that.
Yeah.
Barbara's my nurse and advisor on those things. Now, that came into being when I was young and old enough in my youth to understand the importance of it, because out there, one of his jobs was to take small splinters out of people's eyes. And working with him, as I tried to on occasion, even then, one couldn't help but be impressed with, I suppose you could say, the advent of these new medications. I was around when iodine was discovered as a remedy or cure for thyroid problems. And my father was, as I see him and idolize him, he was very patient and always treated me as if I knew. He didn't, there was no business of pedantry about it. And giving you the feeling he was giving you a lecture. I used to fill all these capsules for him with quinine. Those days you dispensed it by filling the capsules and packaging them. I used to put capsicum, C-A-P-S-I-C-U-M, with the quinine. I can't find anybody today who tells me why. But it gave them a nice little speckled appearance. At all events, even helped him later with a little bit of surgery as an assistant, and I saw for the first time the effect of morphine. If I dwell too much on any of these things, why, it close me up. But I'm just trying to give you a background of my life in that period, and to which I attribute a great deal of my general interest.
Well, please, no, please proceed with what your discussion.
The morphine, I've learned later, it's something to be carefully watched. Out in the country, when you were called to a farmhouse 5 or 6 miles away and you rode out, my father didn't know what to expect. But he did expect a dishpan, a breadboard, a tea kettle. That was his armament when he got to the house, because sometimes he had to lance or he had to suture a cut, things of that sort. He carried with him a drugstore. His saddlebags all had the bottles of liquid in them. Thirty or 40 in the two bags that hung down over the horse's saddle. And he carried cases of the powdered medications. So, in effect, he had to be his own drugstore. There was no such thing in the area. Going back to the morphine, and I'll finish with that. He had a little porcelain cup with a handle, alcohol lamp, and a hypodermic. And you get out there was no such thing as carefully sanitized water. Just any water that was around, it was usually well water. He'd draw this hypodermic up until he got what he thought was appropriate injection. He squirted that water into the little bowl, pulled out his pocket knife, which was a sacred tool, opened it up, opened this bottle of powder of morphine. He just took out, looked at his knife, measured it, dropped it into the receptacle with the water, held it over the alcohol lamp, boiled it, pulled it into the syringe and injected it. And there you saw the mysterious effect of the anesthesia, local anesthesia. Now, all these things were just a natural bit of education. When it came to the saddlery, I learned a bit about leather work. They did stitching that was so delicate that one couldn't help but marvel. How did they do it? They used a pig bristle. It had to be a boar. I'm talking about the sex, the male. And back on the spine, what you might call the hackles, or if you were a chicken, but this was not a chicken. And there was a particular hair from that region of the spine of the boar. It was a bifurcated hair. It had two tips to it. So what they did was to put a linen thread, like a doctor trying to build up a suture, stretch it out and take several threads, depending on how much of a principal thread they wanted to end up with, wax it using beeswax, take the tips of the bristle and the hair loosened up, the threads loosened, and wind it and wax it And there they had a beautiful, delicate means of stitching. And used an awl to make the hole and then just stick this thing through. And so they did their stitching like that, did a beautiful job. Again, there's just, I'm emotional about it, granted, but there was so much that one could learn without any sensing that it's you're being educated. No forceful method, but you're just learning by association. Now, I went the same path as my brother. I was interested in building steam engines and running, playing around with electric motors and how to make an ordinary battery. It was commonplace to do this, and part of it because you're alone out there and you naturally long for something to do. There was always something to do. It made a carpenter out of me. I'm fairly proud of what I was able to do, even as a young one. My brother had already organized a nice workshop. And having three sisters above me, I won't say that my mother was preoccupied with them, but these daughters were very important to help. And I was kind of left on the loose, I suppose, to find my own ways of entertainment. So I have to give credit to the sisters for what they demanded of my mother. On the other hand, my mother was a great one to read to us. And out in the country, I, for one, with my preoccupation, would get part of my education out of a Sears Roebuck or a Montgomery Ward catalog. I've always respected him since because I hope some scholar will do writing on the subject, because in the country they meant so much to everybody. It gave one an idea of what's going on in the cities and what was available for you. It was the two companies were dealers in the useful products, clothing, farm equipment, steam engines, unlimited, even camera equipment when it came along. I still have the 1908 version from which I ordered a rifle, as I remember it, and even a ruby glass for a darkroom and things of that sort. And out there in the country, you waited with your tongue hanging out for the package to come with whatever you had ordered. The mail out there, by the way, was
Why don't we pause for a minute? Yeah.
Town was, of Westphalia, was 9 or 10 miles from the Missouri Pacific Railroad station, a stopping point between St. Louis and Kansas City. That particular railroad went through Jefferson City, the capital of Missouri. The local station that we used was Osage City, a little bit of a settlement on the railroad. They had a the usual equipment of those days, a telegraph facility. It was a kind of a mixture of Western Union and railroads, because the railroads were then, by my day, they were using buck signals and that sort of thing. And in the station were keys for transmitting, there were sounders, there were relays, and under the deck of these instruments were gravity batteries. Beautiful technical gadgets of jars about that high, and it was a mixture of a copper sulfate solution, and it separated itself so it was nice for a youngster to look at. It, down below it was blue as I remember it, and up above ordinary clear water. And it stirred one's curiosity. I was later to become deeply interested in communication. Now, we had to, and to get to that station, we went in what was called a hack, H-A-C-K. It went to this little town every morning, starting from home, a country town, at Westphalia at 6 in the morning, and getting back 5 that night. And that was the means of taking us to and from the railroad station, and the means of bringing the mail and taking out the mail each day. So we did have daily mail in that sense. Local post, little post office. And to get down to Osage City to the railroad, we had to ferry the Osage River. That involved ferrying, and as I recall it, my younger days of memory, the barge, they call it a barge, the wagon had to go down to the edge of the river and get up on the barge, and then it was rowed manually across the river. And to a youngster, that was kind of an interesting and exciting experience. I don't think we worried about dangers. And that was our means of communicating by mail with the outside world. Now, all in all, I believe that's as much as I need to give, excepting for this edition, which I believe is germane. For reasons that I will not try to debate, we were taught to treat everybody older by the term Mr. We were never lectured on it, but we were brought up not to call older people by their first name.
Could we pause for just a moment while I switch the tapes over?